Welcome to Keeping Up, powered by Vanderbilt Emergency Medicine. It's week 50, and this is Clay, the Sushi Roll Smith. I'm here with
Mike Johnston.
So we have a new paradigm here at Keeping Up. We've gotten some feedback from our users. We're going to make it every other week. We're going to improve the quality of the articles, and we're going to make it shorter. You may obtain CME credit simply by listening today and reading at least one of the articles presented. See the CME disclosure on screen and go to our website, keepingup.org, to learn more. So without further ado, let's get started. All right, first up, Cohen et al., high-flow oxygen for cluster headache, a randomized controlled trial. This is in JAMA, December. The study question is, can high-flow oxygen relieve the pain of cluster headache? 76 patients from the UK with neurologist-confirmed episodic or chronic cluster headache were randomized in this placebo-controlled double-blinded crossover study to high-flow oxygen or air over four headache attacks. At 15 minutes, 78% with high-flow oxygen versus only 20% with air were pain-free or had adequate relief. None had adverse events. Now, the limitations, it was a single-center study. Migraineurs and COPD patients were excluded. Nine lost their headache diaries. Some cluster headaches actually resolve spontaneously within 15 minutes, although not that many. And you have to use caution, of course, with smokers and high-flow oxygen. But the take-home is this. High-flow oxygen really works for cluster headache. We asked Dr. Keith Wren, Vice Chair of the Department of Emergency Medicine here at Vanderbilt, if he'd be using this treatment.
Based on the results, which show that oxygen clearly does affect cluster headaches when given at onset, I will be doing this. It's not a change in my practice, however. I've used high-flow oxygen for cluster headaches in the past fairly liberally.
The next article is by Kim et al. Appropriate laryngeal mask airway size for overweight and underweight children from the British Journal of Anesthesia. This is an e-publication ahead of print. The print is coming out next month, January 2010. The study question, is ideal body weight better than actual body weight when choosing laryngeal mask airway size for pediatric patients? Their results, they took 26 overweight children with a BMI of greater than 85% and 26 underweight children with a BMI of less than 15th percentile. And they had LMAs inserted based on both actual weight and ideal body weight. For the overweight children, they found that LMA fit was better as defined by a higher oropharyngeal leak pressure using their actual weight. For the underweight children, LMA fit was better using the ideal body weight as estimated from a standard table. Limitations of this study, it's small sample size, single center. This was done in the operating room only, which may certainly limit its generalizability. The take-home message is that weight does matter when choosing pediatric LMA sizes. For the big kids, use their actual weight. For the tiny ones, use their ideal body weight.
Okay, next up, Jefferson et al., neuraminidase inhibitors for preventing and treating influenza in healthy adults. Now, this is a meta-analysis in the British Medical Journal, December. So how effective are neuraminidase inhibitors in healthy adults? The results, they found 20 studies, and there was no evidence for oseltamivir or zanamivir for prophylaxis against influenza-like illness. Now, lab-confirmed influenza rates were lower if they were used in a prophylactic way. Now, for post-exposure prophylaxis, these drugs were highly effective. Both drugs had a modest effect in reducing influenza symptoms. They took your illness from 4 days to 3.3 days. Evidence for harm from neuraminidase inhibitors was scant. Nausea was a problem for oseltamivir, nearly twice that of placebo. There was also insufficient evidence to determine if these drugs prevented serious complications. Limitations were only 5 studies were high quality by the Cochrane standards, and adverse events were underreported. The take-home is this. Neuraminidase inhibitors, such as oseltamivir and zanamivir, are probably not needed in healthy people, but H1N1 may behave differently, so keep your eyes peeled.
Moving on, Wolf et al., serious bacterial infection in recently immunized young febrile infants from December's Academic Emergency Medicine. The study question, what is the prevalence of serious bacterial infection among recently vaccinated febrile infants? Results of the study, the prevalence of serious bacterial infection in non-recently immunized infants ages 6 to 12 weeks with fever was 7% overall. It's 124 out of 1,700 patients, roughly. Prevalence among recently immunized infants was 2.8%, or 6 out of 211. If it had been less than 24 hours since vaccination, the prevalence was actually 0.6%. but it went up to 8.9% if it's been more than 24 hours after vaccination. All the serious bacterial infections in the recently immunized infants were urinary tract infections. Overall, serious bacterial infection risk was lower among those recently immunized with a relative risk of 0.41. Limitations of this study, it's retrospective, single center, small sample size, and vaccine recommendations may change over time. The take-home message here, febrile infants presenting within 24 hours of vaccination have less than half the risk of serious bacterial infection, and the workup may be limited.
Sayegh et al., reduction of acute anterior dislocations of the shoulder. This was a randomized study of a new reduction technique. Now, the study question is, how does this new reduction technique fare against older reduction techniques such as the Coker and Hippocratic methods? They found that 154 adult ED patients in Greece with first-time anterior dislocation without humerus fracture or any analgesics or muscle relaxers were randomized to reduction by one of the above methods. This new method, called the FARES method, F-A-R-E-S, was 90% successful, compared with only 73% using the Hippocratic method and 68% using the Coker method. It was twice as fast and one-third less painful. And all these reductions were done with no sedation. Limitations, this is a small study, and of course, blinding was impossible. Take home is this: the new FARES method, F-A-R-E-S, works well with less pain. You may be wondering, what is this new technique and what is the Hippocratic and Coker methods? What do they look like? Well, check out our video. We've got it online so you can see it.
Miles et al., a comparison of single photon emission CT lung scintigraphy and CT pulmonary angiography for the diagnosis of pulmonary embolism. This is from this month, December's issue of Chest. The study's question, how does SPECT scintigraphy compare to CT pulmonary angiography? They took a convenient sample of 100 patients and had final results on 79 of these patients with suspected PE. All 79 of these had both planar scintigraphy, SPECT scintigraphy, and CT pulmonary angiography. The diagnostic agreement between the SPECT and the CT pulmonary angiography was 95%. Using reference physician diagnosis as their gold standard, they calculated that SPECT scintigraphy has a sensitivity of 83%, fairly good, and a specificity of 98%, which is excellent. For the diagnosis of pulmonary embolism, SPECT involves less radiation, has less risk of adverse reactions, and may be used in more patients than CT pulmonary angiography. Limitations of the study. It has a small sample size. These were all older patients over age 50. There was no universal gold standard other than physician diagnosis. Fewer alternative diagnoses are diagnosed on SPECT, and they did use a 16-detector CT scanner. Take-home point, SPECT scintigraphy is an alternative to CT pulmonary angiography for the diagnosis of pulmonary embolism. More data is needed.
Yeah, this level of evidence is down to about a 3 because of the lack of a gold standard. Next up, Smith, Bindman et al., radiation dose associated with common CT examinations and the associated lifetime attributable risk of cancer. This is an important study in Archives of Internal Medicine this month. So the question is, what is the radiation dose for common CT exams? They found 1,119 consecutive patients from four California hospitals had radiation doses from CT measured in millisieverts in this retrospective cross-sectional study. The median head CT dose was 2 millisieverts. The neck was 4. Chest was 8. If they were suspecting PE, it was 10. Coronary CTA, 22 millisieverts. And a non-contrast abdomen pelvis, 15. Multiphase abdomen pelvis, 31 millisieverts. There was 13-fold variation for each type of CT. Wow. Wide dose variation occurred within and across institutions as well. So if you have a sample of 20-year-old women, you'd have to do 4,360 head CTs to result in one radiation-induced cancer. But in that same group of 20-year-old women, only 150 coronary CTAs would need to be done for one malignancy to result. Now, males and older patients, of course, have lower risk. Limitations, these doses of radiation were based on calculations, not actual measurements. The risk of cancer was extrapolated from biological effects of ionizing radiation 7 risk estimates. The take-home, limit CT whenever it's safe to do so. Consider alternative imaging and take a patient's radiographic history before you do the next scan.
Barrington de Gonzalez et al. Projected cancer risk from computed tomographic scans performed in the United States in 2007. This is also from this month's Archives of Internal Medicine. The study question, what is the estimated future risk of malignancy attributable to CT use in the United States? The results, using estimates of United States CT use in 2007, which is approximately 72 million studies, and radiation risk models, authors estimate that 29,000 future malignancies, or 2% overall, are attributable to CT use. CT of the abdomen and pelvis was the largest contributor, followed by chest, head, and chest CTA. One-third of projected cancers were due to scans done between the ages of 35 and 54 years. Two-thirds were in women. In the accompanying editorial, Redberg argues that radiation exposure for medical imaging is higher than previously estimated, and clinicians should assess the benefit of each scan and inform patients of risks. Limitations of this study, it was based on statistical modeling, and the true lifetime risk is unknown. The take-home point, CT scanning has risks, including the risk of future malignancies. Total dose reduction as well as alternative imaging strategies should be pursued where appropriate.
Next up, Shulman et al. For the RECOVER group, dabigatran versus warfarin in the treatment of acute venous thromboembolism. This is in the New England Journal, December edition, just last week. So the question is, does the oral direct thrombin inhibitor, dabigatran, have similar effectiveness and safety as warfarin? 2,539 patients were randomized to dabigatran versus warfarin. The two were equally effective and safe, and dabigatran had significantly less overall bleeding. More patients, however, stopped this new drug than the ones on warfarin due to adverse effects, especially dyspepsia. That was 9% versus 6.8%. Now, the limitations, quote, the study was funded, designed, and conducted, and the data analyzed by Boehringer Ingelheim, end quote. Also, dabigatran cannot be used in renal failure patients. The take-home, you'll likely be seeing this new drug, dabigatran or Pradaxa, take the place of warfarin as it needs no lab monitoring. We asked again Dr. Wren what he thought of this study.
The main way it's going to affect us in the ED is by not being able to tell in certain people who are bleeding whether there's a reversal agent that's as good as vitamin K plus FFP. This is a well-done article with a lot of patients. It's a non-inferiority trial, which irked me because they're a way for the drug companies to spend less money on marketing their drug. However, it's a well-done study. I do think we will be doing this, and it's easier to use than Coumadin.
Tsai et al. Contraindicated medication use in dialysis patients undergoing percutaneous coronary intervention. This is from JAMA this month, December. Study question, how many dialysis patients receive a contraindicated or not recommended drug during percutaneous coronary intervention? Their results, 22% received a contraindicated antithrombotic, 47% received enoxaparin, 64% received eptifibatide, 11% received both. Odds of in-hospital bleeding was nearly doubled, as was death. Odds ratios of 1.93 and 1.63, respectively. Risks remained elevated after multivariate analysis. However, utilizing propensity scores among matched patients, only the risk of bleeding was elevated, but not that of in-hospital death. Limitations, it's an observational study. There's potential for unmeasured confounders. Hemorrhagic stroke was not distinguished from ischemic stroke. Take-home point, do not use contraindicated antithrombotics in dialysis patients undergoing percutaneous coronary intervention.
If people don't have kidneys, don't use enoxaparin or eptifibatide. Let's do the bullets. First, high-flow oxygen really works for cluster headache.
Weight does matter for pediatric LMA choice. Bigger kids use their actual weight. Tiny kids use an ideal body weight.
Next, neuraminidase inhibitors are probably not needed in healthy people, but H1N1 may behave differently, so be careful.
Febrile infants presenting within 24 hours of vaccination have less than half the risk of serious bacterial infection. Their workup may be limited.
There's a new shoulder reduction technique out in the world, the Fares method, and it works with less pain, and it's highly effective.
SPECT scintigraphy is an alternative for CT pulmonary angiography for the diagnosis of pulmonary embolism, but more data is needed.
Limit CT use whenever it's safe to do so. Consider alternative imaging, and take a patient's radiographic history before you order the next scan.
CT imaging does have risks, including future malignancies. Total dose reduction as well as alternative imaging strategies should be pursued where you can.
And you'll likely see dabigatran or Pradaxa take the place of warfarin because it needs no lab monitoring, so be on the lookout for this drug showing up in your ED soon.
And finally, don't use contraindicated antithrombotics in dialysis patients when they're going for percutaneous coronary intervention.
Hey, thanks for listening this week. We hope it's been a pleasure. We've had a great time doing it. Everyone have a great holiday. We'll see you next year. And until next time, keep on keeping up.